Welcome and welcome back to the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Saunders, and it is so great to be speaking with you again in our flagship solo episode format. This is the 8th episode of the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast, where we provide you with tangible, actionable tips and steps to improve your fundraising. And today we are going to be talking about experimental fundraising tests, or Fundraising X, as I've coined it. We'll get into why it's called Fundraising X, but experimental fundraising tips to help you test into new trends and gain those critical first-to-market advantages, which are so important for gaining an edge in fundraising and getting out ahead of the marketplace and keeping ahead of trends before the case studies and before the white papers get published. And we are going to get right into that. I do want to start by saying a special hello to any new listeners who've come on board from the Data Strategy Forum, which I co-chaired and moderated several segments on. So welcome if you came from there. Same thing for people who I met at the Next After NIO Summit. Welcome aboard to the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast, where our mission is to advocate for an unsiloed approach to fundraising. And we do that by bringing together the worlds of direct mail, digital, programmatic, and communications within the nonprofit world in order to create a more cohesive donor experience and build stronger nonprofit organizations. And of course, we appreciate everyone who has been with us over the last couple of years on this journey. And if you're part of the over 3,000 fundraisers who have downloaded podcasts, whether it's our solo episodes or interviews or quick takes or any of the other content which we published, we thank you so much for helping contribute to that mission. And you are a big part of our success, and we certainly thank you for that. And we are going to get it right into talking about our Fundraising X tips. And before we do that, though, I wanted to focus on something to start off with that's a little less exciting, but I think just as critical as our Fundraising X tips, and that's inflation. And I know that may not jump off the page or out of your speakers with excitement to talk about inflation, but it is a reality that we should be talking about and thinking about, because it does it is impacting our donors almost universally at this point. And there's no knowing what the future is going to hold, what the impact on rising inflation is going to ultimately have on giving. But I do think that we can look at tea leaves and make contingency plans and maybe structure some tests in a way to help prepare for the impact, mitigate that impact if it is in fact going to be there during this end of year giving season, as well as apply some lessons learned from the pandemic. And that is to plan for the unexpected and never be caught off guard by failing to imagine of possibilities. And I do think we are there right now with inflation, where we have to seriously be looking at the possibility that it is going to impact giving. And I want to open up with some statistics here just to kind of draw the picture of where we're at. So as I'm recording this, it is very late October, right before Halloween. We just had inflation data come out for September, and September was the 5th consecutive month where we had inflation over 5%. So we are right now seeing a historical level of inflation. There was a brief period where we were at this level in 2008, right before or in the midst of the financial disaster of 2008-2009. But otherwise, this is something that we haven't seen in decades, which is important to keep in mind, because there are not a lot of people in the industry who have that historical perspective. We talk a lot about experience and how to navigate emergencies and changes in circumstances based on past experiences. Well, there's not a lot of people left in the fundraising sector who remember fundraising during extreme periods of inflation, which we really haven't seen in this country since the 70s and into the early 80s. So there isn't necessarily a lot of historical perspective to help to guide us, but I think we could still make some informed decisions here. And regardless, one thing that's important to touch on here is that when we start talking about inflation, the conversation inevitably does turn to be political. And I'm not here to answer the question about whether this is being driven by the $6 trillion of emergency stimulus, which the government responded to an unprecedented crisis during the pandemic, or whether this is something that is simply an inevitable function of shutting down an economy and then restarting it. And now we have too much money chasing after too few goods. Some of this may have just been inevitable. Regardless of the cause, regardless of what's responsible, I do think it's important to acknowledge that inflation right now is a fact of life, and that 5% figure doesn't really sum up the everyday experiences of a lot of our donors. So I have some additional statistics here from CNBC, and these are sourced from the Labor Department. This article is from just earlier this month, just a couple weeks ago, and it lists price increases by category. Gas is up 42%. If you drive, you know that full well. Used cars, 24%. Hotels, 18%. TVs, 12.7%. Furniture, 11%. Meat, poultry, fish, and eggs, 10.5%. So now we're getting into, we're moving away from luxury items and into everyday essentials here. And again, if you do the grocery shopping in your household, you know that all too well, that prices have increased, or you're just not seeing as many sales as you were seeing a few months ago. So that's something that hits most of your donors in the wallet, in the pocketbook, every week that they go to the grocery store. New cars, 8.7% increase, appliances, 7%, electricity, 5%, restaurant prices, 4.7%. Not included on here, but expected to be a sharp increase this winter is the cost of heating with natural gas. So a lot of our donors are going to be seeing increased costs for heating their home. And we already talked about the cost of electricity there. So these are everyday essentials. And that is what is so different about an inflation crisis compared to just a typical recession. You know, recession may not be a recession. Maybe a recession for you if you lose your job may not be a recession for your neighbors if they keep their job. And that's what we a lot of us experienced during the pandemic, is that split dynamic where so many people had their incomes interrupted, but other people kept their jobs, actually increased their savings because they had lower expenses, and you had that split dynamic. Inflation hits everybody, and it's more impactful. It's more impactful for households with working class salaries. So certainly below $100,000, and then certainly even more so below $50,000. I actually saw some data from Deloitte, which showed that 11% of households in the United States say that they are not going to be buying any holiday presents this holiday season. So think about that. And that was particularly pervasive in households which make below $50,000. So what that tells you is that people are feeling the pinch of inflation, and they're starting to assume that it's with us for the long haul. And even the early estimates that this was going to be transitory have now evolved into it's going to be a longer term situation, which lasts most likely into 2022, hopefully not beyond that. But it's not a temporary transitory thing where the economy and the supply chain is just kind of catching up. This is something that's with us for the long haul, unfortunately. So that's getting baked into consumer expectations. People are looking ahead to the holidays. They're making adjustments in their planning, the gifts that they're going to buy for family members, whether they're going to buy gifts at all. And that psychological component is so critical here, because that's a big part of what drives consumer spending, is how they feel, not just about their personal situation, but the future moving forward. And right now, the polls suggest that Americans are very pessimistic about the economy. They think we could be heading for a recession next year. But regardless of whether we are heading for stagflation or an actual recession, this presence of inflation is something which is psychologically impacting how Americans feel. And the reality is this, and sometimes this is a point of great debate within the nonprofit world, is whether giving is a consumer commercial behavior. And regardless of where you stand on that philosophically, and there's a lot to be said about having an abundance mindset versus a scarcity mindset, the bottom line is that when you are asking for donations, you are competing with every other expense that that consumer has. And if people are thinking already that they're cutting back for the holiday season, or they're not going to be participating in giving this holiday season because of how they feel about their situation and the economy, I don't see how that doesn't impact giving. Maybe there are a handful of special individuals out there who will still give at their normal levels, but my expectation, again, not an expert on economics, just kind of reading the data, reading the tea leaves, inserting some intuition about human behavior, is that you will see people cut back on their giving. How that adds up in the bigger picture, we'll just have to see. But I would certainly start to think about the possibility that you could see a decrease this holiday season in giving as a result of everything which is going on in price increases, because in addition to the actual economic impact, that psychological impact is just so, it's probably even more impactful, to be honest, because everywhere you go, you're getting notices from companies saying we need to pass along a price increase due to the increased cost of materials. I mean, I just got a letter, very nice letter in the mail from the company that does our trash removal, saying that they had to increase our bill $1 a month because of rising costs due to inflation. They held off as long as they could, but they need to pass it along, and they, because they think that the price increases are going to be over the long term. And consumers are getting those kinds of notices everywhere. And the dollar here, dollar there, that may not make a big difference, but those signs that we're seeing everywhere, these emails, these notices that they're getting from companies, it's all baking in the inflation psychologically. And I could certainly see that having a toll on giving. So what do we do about it? We do spend a lot of time in the nonprofit world talking about issues, worrying about issues, whether it's paper or postage or economic circumstances. I don't think we spend nearly enough trying to get ahead of those problems and saying, okay, what can we do to address them? Here is what I would be doing. I think that we talk about a lot about testing empathetic language to your donors during a recession, during periods of high unemployment, acknowledging we know that a lot of people are going through tough times. But we still have this incredible need here. And I don't see any reason not to test language like that as it pertains to inflation, because the impact is so universal. And again, I say test because we don't want to make changes which may have unintended consequences. But if you do an A-B test and insert some empathetic language talking about, you know, we realize that consumers, that donors are being hit hard this season by rising grocery and fuel and electricity costs, and you know, we're anticipating donors cutting back this year as a result. What you do is you start to activate people who are in a position to continue giving, maybe even increase their giving, because you plant that seed that, hey, a big part of the donor base may be having more severe issues than I am personally, and encouraging them to increase their support without actually asking them to do that. You're just kind of planting those seeds, reminding them that these things that you're feeling personally are hitting us as a nonprofit. Certainly, if you're in a nonprofit where you're being hit by cost increases, either because of materials or food or whatever the costs are that pertain to your programmatic activity, I would certainly be focusing in on those, because consumers are hearing those everywhere. And if anything, they've become more attuned very quickly and forgiving for having those price increases passed along to them. So they're certainly going to understand on the charitable end. And the reality is, this is the other reason why these are good things to focus in on, is because of lessons that we learned during the pandemic, that even when people are pushed to their breaking point, when the world is coming around down around us, as it all was at the start of the pandemic, almost 2 years ago, people still bear down and they protected the things that they cared about personally, that they personally identified with. And many of those things were charities. Not all of them, though. If you look at the response to local restaurants in the early days of the pandemic, I think that was really telling, that people, with so much financial uncertainty going on, they understood that the pandemic and the closures were going to have the ability to uniquely impact these restaurants, which are such an important part of the character that make up many communities, that they wanted to do their part to chip in, take out order here or there to help support these restaurants. So it wasn't just charities, as heartening as the response was, for giving in general, with people donating to their local food banks for the first time and all kinds of other causes that weren't even related to COVID relief. That behavior, that charitable impulse was evident throughout our society during those early months. So if you activate your donors and you let them know, hey, this macroeconomic situation with inflation, it could impact our mission, our ability to provide relief, or whatever your mission is. Donors will respond to that, sometimes even if they're being challenged personally, because even during a time of personal crisis, people want to protect the things that are important to them that they personally identify with, and that includes nonprofits as well. So I hope you take that advice to heart and think about that. How are some ways that you can start messaging around inflation to try to be empathetic with your donors, connect with them, let them know that there may be a need there, A/B test it, and see if it has a positive impact on your results and maybe stems any losses that you may be seeing this end of year season coming up. But with that, we are now going to transition into the heart of our show with 5 fundraising X tips to help you get ahead of coming trends. One more note to put a bow on our discussion about how to insulate yourself from the impacts of inflation. This is a really important moment to shore up your relationships with your major donors and also your donor advised fund donors in particular, by calling them, literally calling them on the phone, reaching out to them, just talking to them and thanking them for their support, finding out what's important to them, why they give, because those donors who are giving from donor advised funds or have significant assets are going to be impacted very differently by inflation than donors with working class salaries or who are living paycheck to paycheck, who may feel the erosion of their spending power much more. And, you know, right now, if your income stream is primarily from the stock market or if it's just from your weekly paycheck, you're seeing you're seeing inflation and feeling it very differently right now. And major donors who have the capacity to give more, or even donors with significant assets who can dig a little bit deeper without it impacting them in the same way, are usually willing to step up during a time of crisis when to make up for other donors who aren't able to give, but you have to initiate those conversations. One of my favorite sayings is dig the well before you're thirsty. So shore up, fortify those relationships, increase your points of contact, the value that you're providing to those donors, and listening to them before you need to go and make an emergency ask towards the end of the year because you're seeing yourself coming up short on fundraising. Whether it's because of the impact of inflation or something else, dig the well before you're thirsty, fortify those relationships now, and it will pay off later on, especially if you really need them to. But now let's get into Fundraising X. And first, I want to give a quick primer about why I call it Fundraising X. It's actually named after Google X, which is now called the X Development Corporation. And this is a project that Google established for their moonshot projects. So these are things that may not have a short-term payoff or may even have a high failure rate, but projects which could be transformative for the company, for society as a whole. This is where development of Google's driverless car started. Another project that came out of Google X was Google Glass. They're working on a whole bunch of things that you've never heard of, either because they failed or because they're in development phase. I believe they're working on a project now to provide Wi-Fi to developing countries and rural areas from weather balloons. So they're working on all kinds of great things that could be transformative projects, but they're not afraid of the possibility of failure. They're embracing failure in the same way that the scientists who were responsible for putting a man on the moon did, understanding that you need to embrace failure, learn from it, not be afraid of it. Now, that doesn't mean that we recommend testing recklessly. I never do that. I think every organization should allocate a certain amount of their budget to testing ventures where they're not counting on those returns. But these are experimental tests or fundraising X tests where they have a high degree of upside if they do work. In a lot of cases, that's going to be because you're going to be gaining a first to market advantage. And that's where, whether you're in the for-profit world or the nonprofit world, that's really where the growth opportunities come from, was when you test into something or discover something before the rest of the marketplace does, because when it becomes a best practice, everyone catches up very quickly. And the bigger companies or the bigger organizations at that point will tend to bury the smaller one. So it's important, especially if you're a small to mid-sized organization, to have that growth mindset, that testing mindset. So that's where the term fundraising X comes from. This is experimental testing to try to get ahead of trends before the white papers and before the case studies get published. And it's probably best exemplified by our first fundraising X test, and that is testing QR codes in your direct mail. QR codes have had quite a journey, which of course has been impacted significantly by COVID-19, but most people don't realize this, but QR codes are actually close to 20 years old. So that just shows you the tail life on these newer technologies and how long adaptation can take. They first were widely used in Japan, and it was probably about 10 years ago that they started to appear in advertising in the United States. And you remember this if you had a smartphone at the time. There was a lot of excitement about QR codes and their potential to create more immersive experiences for consumers. The problem is you had to go into a third-party app. Back then, it took longer to download apps. A lot of times the apps, the QR apps didn't work. So it became a very bulky experience, which companies quickly started to abandon. And QR code usage was very limited, even leading up to the COVID-19 pandemic. And that's when everything started to change. Actually, according to this article that I'm going to reference, in 2012, Inc. magazine stated that 97% of consumers did not even know what a QR code was. So think about how far we've come. The evolution of QR codes really accelerated after Snapchat started to utilize them. That was in 2017 is when that first started to happen. And the same year, Apple updated their camera to integrate the ability to read QR codes. That was really what kind of set the stage for what the transformation that we underwent with QR codes during the pandemic is, the fact that it became a turnkey experience where you could just point your camera at it and pick up the QR code and be taken to a website. You didn't have to go to another app. It works most of the times. I test it out all the time. It's pretty seamless. That really was the game changer, was the integration into the cameras in our smartphones. 2020, QR code interaction grew by 94%. And why was that? Primarily, it was part of a natural growth curve, but of course, this was from restaurants abandoning paper menus during the pandemic when they reopened and instead using QR codes and having menus on your phone. So we're now at a point where virtually anybody who's been to a restaurant in the last 2 years, my God, has it been that long? Almost 2 years, hard to believe. Now knows what a QR code is. And that's the battle, half the battle with new technologies is adaptation. But here we've had an event which has completely shifted all of that. I have some data here from Statista to give you an idea of where you're at. So this is from June 2021, and it's percentage of shoppers by age who have used a marketing-related QR code within the last 3 months. The average is 45%. But check out what happens here with the ages. 18 to 29 is 54%, 30 to 44, 48%, 45 to 64, 44%, 65 plus, it drops off 31%. But almost half of millennials, Gen Z, also Gen X, and even edging into the baby boomer demographic are using QR codes on a regular basis. And a lot of this adaptation has just been from gaining education about what they are, how to use them. It's become a universal language. You see a QR code, you know what to do. So where does this then cross over into the direct mail world? I don't recommend using QR codes as an exclusive call to action. I don't think that we know nearly enough about their adaptation and fundraising to go there yet. It could be an interesting test if you're an organization that mails primarily to Gen X and younger mailers, and maybe you're using mail pieces that have more of a commercial feel to them. Could be an interesting test, but... this and most of these fundraising X tests are not going to be game changers on their own. I use the term fundraising is a game of inches, and that especially is the case as new channels come onto the scene and they don't ever replace anything. Same thing with new technologies. It just kind of adds to each other and it becomes a game of inches to try to incrementally improve your fundraising and make your organization and giving as accessible to as many people as possible. So that's really the mindset with QR codes. Where to put a QR code on a mail piece? I've heard different theories about this. I've heard of organizations putting it on the back of the envelope, which I think makes sense for mailing to your donors or maybe even lapsed donors, people who instantly recognize the organization, have given before. If they want to give again, they can see the QR code and scan it, go make their gift. And that's really what the QR code is all about. It's about capturing those low-hanging donations, the people who are on the goal line, so to speak, of giving that. They don't need to be convinced by what's inside the envelope. They see the organization and they know that they want to make that gift. And every time, you know, direct mail is very valuable because it lingers, because it sits on our kitchen tables and our counters and we come back to it after a couple days. But it's also dangerous because it's very easy to get distracted in today's world and put down the mail piece and forget to come back and make the donation as well. So that's the beauty of QR codes. Is if somebody is already sold on making the gift, they can scan it from their phone there. They can make the gift right away. They don't have to worry about getting their checkbook or the credit card, getting distracted, putting the mail piece down, having be accidentally thrown out. That's really what this is all about. It's peeling off those low-hanging donations. I have seen some data, some very anecdotal data, that suggests that people who give through QR codes give more than those who respond to the mail. Makes sense to me for the same reason that internet donations tend to give more, because if you're giving through a QR code, you're almost certainly giving from a credit card. We know credit card donations tend to produce a higher average gift than donations that are made from checks. So there could be that benefit as well. The other option, which I'm more inclined to test personally, if I recommend this, is to put it on your reply device, your normal reply device that somebody would use to reply through the mail, and adding some sort of note, scan here to make an immediate donation and put your donation to work right away. That is a very smart value proposition with not just QR codes, but kind of as an extension of this. If you want to try to push people online to make a donation to get that money in the bank right away, again, make sure you're capturing those low-hanging donations and they're not escaping, is to stress that, hey, if you give right now, especially if it's an urgent cause, your money goes to work right away. You don't have to wait for the mail to be sent back, to be caged, and deposited in the bank. It goes to work right away. There's an immediacy to donation. And I think QR codes are also part of that, conveys urgency. If you don't test a QR code, you can always test adding a PS to your letter with an option to give online as well. So it doesn't necessarily have to be QR codes, but I think the QR code really conveys the immediacy. And we're at a point where everybody knows exactly what it is and how to use it. And I think that's probably the future of direct mail to online giving is going to be through QR codes. Again, test. Couple of reasons. You want to make sure that adding another call to action doesn't create confusion. Sometimes confusion creates inertia and actually reduces giving. We see this sometimes if you have a direct mail letter that asks the donor to do too many things. If you ask them to sign a petition and go like your organization on Facebook and make a donation, sometimes the more you ask for, the less you get. But you don't know unless you test. The other reason is it's possible. I haven't seen this bear out yet in my own experience, but I do think it's possible that the presence of a QR code could increase giving on its own. I have heard similar stuff like this with if you accept Bitcoin donations online, that sometimes just indicating and showing the donor that you accept Bitcoins, it creates a psychological connection with them. And for some reason, just the option increases giving, even if they're not actually giving through Bitcoin. So it's possible that it also conveys psychologically that this is an urgent appeal that you really need to respond to. So it's possible that there's the presence of a QR code could in itself increase giving, which is why you really want to A/B test, make sure it's not hurting you negatively, but also so you can measure the positive impact in addition to the people that are actually scanning and making the donation through the QR code. The promise here is that as it grows, again, I think the impact will be incremental in the beginning. The reason why this is Fundraising X is that I think this is only going to grow. We could get to a point in 10 years where it makes sense to mail a mail piece to your best donors or your best list that has a QR code call to action because it's going to become so commonplace. At this point, the data I've seen is that only about 1 in 10 consumers actually make payments through QR codes. So that's why I'm saying this is probably talking about incremental donations at best at this point. But we've been there before with technology. We know how quickly it grows. If something makes it easier for consumers to make a purchase, it's only going to become more turnkey in the future, and companies are going to continue to push this technology if it's shown to increase sales. And as consumers gain adaptation and as they use it in the for-profit marketplace, they're going to use it in the nonprofit marketplace. So it's better to test early. There may be an incremental benefit right now, but that benefit could grow very quickly in the years ahead. And by testing today, you will put yourself in a position where you will already be in a position to take advantage of those trends when they start to mainline in a few years. So with Fundraising X test number one, we talked about how to go from offline to online using QR codes. We're actually going to talk about the opposite with test number two. And we're going to talk about generating postal prospects online and putting them in the mail. If you're a longtime listener, you may recall that I actually mentioned this as a multi-channel fundraising test back in one of our early episodes. So I actually think that based on my real world experience that online to offline tests are probably a little bit past the point of actually being fundraising X at this point. The reason why I'm repeating it is, one, because I've had more real-world experience with this and I've seen the potential multiple times over the last couple of years, but also because I don't see a lot of adaptation in the marketplace. And I chalk that this up to the lack of unsiloed fundraising, which we always talk so much about, and just simply departments not talking to each other. And you're going to see here why that is so damaging and how that may be holding back your direct mail and your online fundraising. But let's first talk about execution, how you actually do this. The easiest way to do it, and I don't want to say most, but many organizations at this point are doing some sort of Facebook ads that have downloadable content or petitions or surveys where you're asking for an email address, because that's a big focus of working your donors up the communication ladder, so to speak, is to pull them off of social media, or pull them off of your website, get their email address, and then cultivate a direct line of communication with your donor. Makes a lot of sense. And more increasingly, I see this done with downloadable content, eBooks, things like that. So the test here is to talk to your online team that's running these tests and ask them to put in the USPS fields. And I generally suggest it being a non-required field, a little bit counterintuitive perhaps, but I have seen studies where you get more postal addresses if you don't require them than if you do. So again, just put yourself in the mind of the donor. Oh, this organization is asking for it. It's a little bit intrusive. If they're not asking for it, you just view the ask a little bit differently. But people who voluntarily put in their postal address as opposed to be required to, they're basically raising their hand to get direct mail. And that's what makes them such valuable prospects. That and the fact that the demographics between an online user and an offline donor are basically one and the same at this point. And they've probably been for a while. I noticed this well over a decade ago. Had a client who did some online appends, where they appended postal addresses, and they looked at demographic reports, and these users online or people who had supplied their email address, they were maybe about 10 years younger than typical direct mail donor, but not much at all. And I think that those lines have just become even increasingly blurred as we're all essentially multi-channel consumers at this point. But that's the easiest way to enact this test, is to simply build it on top of something that you're already doing. And I will tell you, in a lot of cases, you will get pushback from your online team because, full disclosure, asking for more fields, even if they're not mandatory, it will decrease the number of leads that they get. But that's where the A/B testing is so critical and so easy to do online, is to compare how many leads do you get when you do have an opportunity to supply postal information versus when you're just asking for email address or whatever other information that you're currently asking for. And not just see how it impacts your leads, but also look down the funnel to see how it impacts donors. So a lot of online fundraisers, or if they're not working in fundraising, if they're working in communication, are still judged based on the leads acquired. But really what we should be looking at is what happens to those leads, because in a lot of cases, you're better off acquiring fewer, more qualified leads that are, and they're going to convert in more donors, as opposed to acquiring massive amounts of leads with low-hanging appeals or things that are going to acquire lots of names, because just the quality of the lead, the quality of the prospect is going to be that much better. It's the difference between if you have a one question survey and enter your email address versus a 20 question survey. the 20 question survey is going to get far fewer names because there's more inertia, more time required to do it, but the quality of the prospect's going to be the better. That's the same thought process with prospects who do supply their USPS addresses. I've seen this done a number of ways. So if you're an organization who has petitions or some other type of page on your website or offer that you're putting out on social media that asks the user to sign on with their information, it works best if you can match up the petition to your direct mail appeal, if it has a similar theme. Again, that's where coordinating between the two departments can be helpful, because if you have an online team that's already doing this, they can design a campaign which has similar themes to your online, to your offline campaign. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Even if you have an ebook and then your direct mail letter is more institutional, they still may respond to the direct mail letter. You really have to put it in the mail and test and find out. But in this case, your only risk is really the cost of mailing those names. And the upside to all this is, if it works, is that online lead generation is highly scalable. Where organizations get themselves into trouble is they scale too much based on the premise of acquiring names without looking at the quality, without looking at how many leads those donors are actually producing. But the best way to get this started is to simply have a meeting of the minds between your online development or communications team, whoever's handling your online advertising or website where you may already be asking for email leads, and talk with to your direct mail team about how you can work together to do that. And at the end of the day, this does not devalue online communication or online lead generation at all, because if you can produce more donors by acquiring fewer names, it's going to make the jobs of the online department much more valuable. And as you get into this, and of course it benefits the direct mail program as well, but as you get into this, then you can start doing optimization testing. I have seen this most successful when done through the context of a petition or a survey, but I actually think that the ebook angle, which a lot of organizations do use for online generation, for email generation, I think that's really compelling, because my gut feeling and my experience so far with the surveys and petitions is that the more time intensive the online content is, where you're acquiring the lead, the better it translates to mail. So somebody that's reading a very long survey or filling out a very long survey or reading a very long petition, that's a behavior which is very conducive to direct mail, which obviously requires more time and attention, where if it's just kind of like a flash capture, it can still work, but it doesn't usually work as well as having people that are consuming a lot of information. Likewise, someone who is responding to an offer for an ebook or an online course, something that requires a lot of time and attention, I think that's a behavior which translates really well to direct mail. But there are different ways that you can test to try to optimize that that unsiloing process. But if you have an online department that is already doing this, that is doing email lead generation, talk to them about testing, adding USPS fields, and then prospecting to those names with your direct mail letters, and you may be stunned at the results. And in many cases, not only is this a scalable solution, but you're going to be reaching prospects who otherwise would have slipped through the cracks and who you are not able to find on traditional direct mail lists, which is what makes this so compelling. And we are just about halfway home here as we enter our third Fundraising X idea to help you get ahead of the trends. We're going to stick with the theme of cross-channel, but we're going to put a different spin on it by talking about cross-channel gratitude testing. Now, as we've talked about in this and past Dynamic Nonprofits content, The industry is discovering and starting to quantify that multiple touch points of engagement with your donors is very valuable. So if you have direct mail donors and are also sending them emails or have a text relationship with them or even social media, these added touch points of engagement, they incrementally add value to your relationship with your donor, make them more valuable, and increase retention and lifetime giving. But what if we take that concept and apply it to gratitude? And here's a couple of solid test ideas. Again, we always want to hope that you walk away from these episodes with some actionable ideas that you can go back to the office or go to your home office if you're still working from home and put them into action right away. So imagine this. You have your direct mail prospecting campaign, or it could be a house file as well. And the donor sends back their donation, gives you their email address. Maybe that gets entered into your email fundraising program if you're retaining that information. And they kind of get put into your digital program or your digital silo. What if you use that information to send the donor an email thank you? So one of the pros of digital fundraising and one of the drawbacks of direct mail is that the gratitude period, there's a very long open period of gratitude there between the time that you send in your donation and get your thank you or your welcome package, whereas the gratitude can be instantaneous with email or really any form of digital donation. But this can cut a little bit time off the gratitude curve because the more time that the sooner you're able to thank your donor, obviously the fresher the donation is in their mind and the newer the relationship is, I think the more impactful the thank you is. So what if when you get the email the direct mail donation, if then their email address is passed along and a lot of this can be automated today and they get either an automated thank you. I have seen organizations, and there's a number of companies that do this, where they actually will send video thank yous to the donor. Smaller organizations can personalize by name. I've actually seen that. But again, this can be programmatic for larger organizations where somebody from the organization actually appears in a video and thanks the donor. Imagine how impactful that is. You know, if you send in a direct mail donation and a week later you have something that pops up in your email and it's a thank you, very impactful, very powerful form of gratitude. Not to replace or to take away from the direct mail gratitude or thank you or welcome package. I think it's really impossible, especially in this day and age of fractured attention, to overthank our donors. And each one of those additional points of gratitude, I think, adds value and just kind of reinforces the warm glow of giving and the positive feelings that they have associated with making that gift. So that's one idea, to do email thank yous. An extension of that can be either instead of or even in addition to is an email welcome series for direct mail donors. This is an idea that excites me a lot. There's a lot of evidence out there about the power of email welcome series for new online donors or even online leads or respondents that are not yet donors, and the power that a good email welcome series can have in helping to increase both initial conversion rates as well as retention rates with online donors. But imagine taking that concept and maybe right after the email thank you, if you're going to do both, then entering them into a new donor email welcome series, or maybe it's a welcome series that's customized to the issue or the content that they responded to in the mail. So adding a layer, really a personalized layer to the relationship with your donor through an email welcome series. Another idea is, and I should mention that as it tends to be the case with direct mail, one of the great advantages of testing with direct mail is that it becomes relatively easy to do A/B testing. So it's not difficult if you have two direct mail panels set up as an A/B test, if half of the names from a mailing go into a panel that will get the email thank you or the email welcome series, and half of them do not, makes it really easy then to compare to see what the incremental lift is, both initially as well as down the line, if these added touch points of engagement actually add value to the relationship with the donor. Very easy to test, very easy to measure and quantify with direct mail. But one other idea is to do phone calls. And the power of the phone call is that, for one thing, it's not expected. A lot of organizations, or not many organizations, I should say, are actually making thank you phone calls to low dollar direct mail donors, or really donors at any level through the mail. But this is really two for the price of one with a thank you phone call. It's one of the reasons why I find this to be so compelling. And I know there is automated technology out there so that if you have the donor's phone number, if that's information that you're asking for and retaining, you can do automated thank you calls where the donor will get a recorded message from the president of your organization or someone associated with the organization. But I love live phone calls for this reason. And listen, hear me out here. Not only do you catch the donor off guard and with the thank you that they're probably not getting from many other organizations, but it's an opportunity to talk to your donor. So we always talk about, right, talk to your donors, understanding why they give. And there's so many technological solutions to do that. There's a lot of talk about the value of doing this right after they give online. And of course, talking to them at things like live events. But here you have the ability, and the key here is to make it clear that you're not asking for anything. You're just calling to say thank you. And, you know, we'd like to know more about our donors. What inspired you to give today? And one thing that I have learned from talking to donors at live events is they are incredibly candid and not shy about sharing their passions and why they choose to give. And you just end up with just amazing insight. And the nice thing about a phone call versus getting this information through a survey or after a donation is you can uncover some of the real nuances and the reasons why they give that you're not going to get through other mediums. So again, the key is to make sure that you're collecting this information and then using it throughout your organization to enhance your fundraising efforts. Again, focusing on the unsiloed aspect of fundraising when you get this information, making sure that it's shared throughout the organization. So you get that benefit of getting that donor intelligence, but you also get the benefit of the thank you. And again, very easy to test to see if these thank you and welcome phone calls provide or increase the value and retention of your donors down the line from that initial touch point, which will catch them, which will most likely catch them off guard simply because so few organizations are doing it. But it's not just the added lifetime value and retention that you're going to see a benefit from making this call. It really has potentially exponential benefits because you get all of that added insight and intelligence into why your donors are giving, which can help you refine your other fundraising efforts as well. And just like that, we have come to our fourth fundraising X test idea. And this one, we are going to talk strictly about mobile and testing the effectiveness of an SMS texting program for your nonprofit or your clients. And before we get into the details, I think it's important to mesh this out a little bit because a lot of times when we talk about SMS or texting, the first assumption goes to candidates, political candidates, campaigns, and election-oriented mailers, things like political committees, things like that, that have become synonymous with texting. And if you've given to one, either for research or in your own time, you know that they are absolutely relentless and, or I would say aggressively relentless in their texting strategy. But a lot of that's born out of necessity. when you're operating in an election environment, you have a hard deadline. There's a sense of urgency. So donors, not only are they likely to give and respond to that urgency, but they may be more forgiving about it because they understand the unique nature of an election occurring every 4 years or every 2 years and needing to raise as much money as possible in order to make an impact in those races. So, and what I like to tell mailers is that that should not necessarily be where you first go when you think about texting. That's a very specific model for very specific kinds of mailers. I do think that if you work in international relief or any type of emergency relief, or you're responding to things like natural disasters or political turmoil or any other type of humanitarian disaster, texting could be a very effective way to raise money. I believe the first time that I made a text to give gift was after Superstorm Sandy devastated the Jersey Shore and much of the state. And we went out to a restaurant that had power. We did not have power. This was about a week or so into it. And I got a text on my phone asking to make a $10 donation to the American Red Cross, which I did. And that is a very effective way to raise money in an emergency. And we've seen time and time again, organizations like the American Red Cross use that when money means saving time and saving lives. But that's not a model that's going to work, I don't think. I'm always open to being proven wrong with evidence, of course. I don't think that's a model that's going to work for most membership organizations or organizations that don't have missions that are conducive to those really hard and urgent deadlines. And if you do have a situation like that, like there's a project that you're trying to finish by a certain date, perhaps it could work as a one-off or something on an annual basis. It's not what I would consider to be sustainable. You know, right? We talk about sustainability with the environment and things like farming and sustainable fishing and farming practices. Well, we should think about fundraising in the same way that, yes, if you go out and you blast your donors for donations and you create a sense of urgency, it could work. But how sustainable is that really if you can't sustain that urgency? That's what the candidates have. That's what the political committees and the PACs and election-oriented mailers and emergency relief mailers have that you can't necessarily recreate with a museum or a membership-based organization or an organization that doesn't constantly have these high-profile deadlines and emergencies where you can text your donors. They know immediately what the emergency is. There's universal awareness, and you want to put the donation form literally at their fingertip where they can make a gift in a few seconds to respond. Not something that I think is sustainable for most nonprofits. Texting, if you use it, it can be abused. You remember, this is an email. This is basically an email with a 90% open rate. So just because something works on a one-off doesn't mean it's a good idea over the long term. There's a lot of ability for organizations to really do more harm than good with the relationships with their donors if they're too aggressive in asking for money with text. However, as a value add, either educationally or giving donors increased or unique access to your organization, I think texting can be a really dynamic layer to add to the relationship with donors. I think the textbook example for this is what the Sierra Club does with their concierge program, where basically if you sign up for text alerts, you can text them a question and have some person actually respond and answer your questions. So very critical if you're going to be sending texts is to recreate the dynamic that people have with their friends and family, right? How do you feel if someone sends, or if you send a text to someone and they don't respond? You don't want that organization, that type of relationship with your nonprofit where you feel like it's a one-way communication or the cat's out of the bag. This is an automated text. There's nobody at the other end. So you absolutely want to be have a way of responding to messages if you're going to engage in this test. But I actually think the idea of creating conversations is really powerful, asking the donors questions, but at the very least, providing them with educational content or special access to the organization, whether it's a concierge type program. And again, if you're an organization that works with parks or trails or outdoor conservation, things like that, where donors can text questions about specific parks and get information, things like that, really enhancing the layers of the relationship, I think is a really powerful way to use SMS. But even if you don't have an organization, I mean, certainly if you run a museum or a cultural center or something like that, opening up the dialogue with your donors, encouraging them to ask questions. And not a lot of organizations are doing this. So it is it's very powerful and very early with this, which is why we consider it to be Fundraising X. But it is a great way to both correspond with your donors, but also to send them educational materials, things that are an added value to increase the depth of the relationship. I'm not saying that you can't use text as a way to try to nudge end of year gifts, or if you have a capital campaign or something like that with a deadline, by all means, add text as a layer to that, but just use it tastefully and respectfully, and make sure with texting, if you're going to go down this road, and I do think it's a very valuable test, is that you're giving more than you're asking from the donor, because much like email, not only are you asking for money, are you asking for attention, you're asking the donor to allow you into their personal space. It's a very intimate thing to be sending text messages, because you really are mimicking that friends and family kind of relationship. Candidates, committees, things like that can get away with pushing the envelope on that relationship and really asking a lot more than they're giving. I don't think that's going to be the case for nonprofits. However, if you use it as a way to provide supplemental education and value, provide unique access, create a two-way dialogue with your donors, a very valuable way to add layers to the relationship, enhance communication with your donors, provide them with value. And again, this can be tested. If you have half of your file, I think House File is lapsed donors are is the place to start with this. Is to start by cultivating phone numbers, and that can be done either through email, through social media ads. It can be done through direct mail with things like postcards, asking for phone numbers on direct mail replies, making sure, of course, that information is being caged and retained and then passed along to the appropriate person in the organization. It's a little bit of a long climb when you're starting off with no numbers and cultivating that information. But what's critically important if you're going to start an SMS program and make sure this is worthwhile, because again, my assumption is this is not going to be a big revenue generator for most organizations. However, what's critical is to have some sort of A/B test where you can compare donors who do enter your SMS program, provide their information, and develop a relationship with text versus those who don't, and see what the value is that you're adding to the relationship in terms of lifetime giving and retention. And this should tell you if it's something that you should expand and roll out program-wide, or something that you really should double down on, or if maybe it's not worth your time and your time and money. Every organization, every dynamic with donors is going to be different. But again, it is early on in the nonprofit world for SMS, and if you're going to try to cultivate a value-based relationship where you're really, providing much more than you're giving and adding layers to the relationship, I think it's a really powerful way to add layers of communication to your relationship with donors in a way which can increase their giving down the line. And down the stretch, we come to our fifth and final fundraising X test to help you get ahead of the trends. And we're going to be talking about monthly giving. But we're not going to be talking about the benefits of a monthly giving program, because I think that is well beyond fundraising X at this point. That's probably as it may not only be a best practice at this point for organizations of all types and sizes to have a monthly giving program. It may be the most important best practice out there. We all know the numbers that monthly donors, they have a 90% retention rate. They give more than one-time donors. They often give in addition to their monthly gifts. They're also excellent, an excellent cultivation or an excellent group of donors that can be cultivated for both major giving as well as legacy giving. You probably know all this already, but if you want a really good 101 overview or even a 401 overview, look back in your feed to my interview with Erica Wassdorp. She really is the foremost authority in the industry for monthly giving, and she has been talking about it for the better part of three decades. And really is an authoritative figure on this topic and how to get a monthly donor program started. But in this tip, we want to talk about how to optimize your monthly donor program and scale it. Most of the data that I have seen suggests that donors who become monthly donors, who become into an organization as a one-time donor, I should say, and then become monthly donors, are most likely to do it within their first 90 days of giving. And really, there may even be another cliff there at 30 days, which sees a steep drop-off. And that's not surprising to me, because even working with one-time donors for my almost 15 years in the industry, I know that the best predictor of whether somebody will give a third gift is how quickly they give a second gift, which is why organizations who have a pause period when donors come into the organization of 30 or 60 days are probably making a terrible mistake if they're not asking for another immediate gift, because you're actually hurting your ability to get that third gift. And monthly giving, I believe based on the data that I've seen and just intuitively, I believe is in that same vein, where if somebody is going to become a donor, a monthly donor, I think they're most likely to do it early on in their relationship with the nonprofit. And that's not how most nonprofits that I see treat a monthly giving program. They may have one. They may even brand it really well and talk about it throughout the organization, the benefits of it. But it's set up as a campaign. Maybe once or twice a year, they go out to their donors and ask them to become a monthly donor, or they have a monthly giving option on their reply cards, making it available to the donors. But it's not something that is necessarily put into the donor's mind all of the time. So the test that the Fundraising X test that I'm suggesting here is a programmatic one, where you test the first ask that you make to a new donor after their welcome package and all of that is a monthly giving ask. And again, thanking them for coming on board and welcoming them to the organization, and immediately implanting the idea of monthly giving in their mind, the importance of it, the benefits of it, both to the donor and to the organization. As well as inserts, testimonials. I mean, this is something I think is very underutilized. Donor testimonials. Think about how powerful that is. An insert that has a quote, or quotes from donors about how much they've enjoyed their relationship with their organization and the benefits that they've seen from monthly giving. I see organizations do this sometimes with legacy gifts, not so much with monthly gifts, but it's still a very powerful tool, especially to put in an initial ask package. And making that the first house file ask or cultivation ask that you make to a new donor. And again, testing, because this one is going to be time, and it is going to be There is going to be an expense associated with it, especially on the direct mail side, because you're talking about adding another package to your house file. But the idea is to test the use of your time as well as your money to see if this is a way to cultivate more monthly donors and get them on board earlier. And again, you need to segment off a section of your new donors who you're not going to enroll in this program. You keep them as is in the regular house file program where they get their 10 or 12 appeals a year. And if you normally ask them for monthly gifts, you do that when you normally would. But the other split gets the programmatic ask, where they automatically, their first ask to the organization is this monthly donor package, and seeing if that is a way to help scale your monthly donor program. And the numbers should be evident after a few months, and certainly after a year, about whether this is something that's going to be beneficial for your organization. And the same thing on the digital side as well. Somebody comes in with a one-time offer, that first appeal that they get from your organization should be for a monthly ask, trying to convert them early on. And the good thing with email is that you can start priming them with the welcome material, educational content about the benefits of monthly giving, and trying to add in that layer in addition to the ask. But that's the test here. It's a monthly donor package or appeal for the first ask that you make for new donors to your organization. And this is all about taking the knowledge that we now have about the power of monthly giving, about how valuable these donors are on so many different levels for the organization, and seeing if asking for your donors early on to become monthly donors, if that helps increase the number of monthly donors, both initially, but also later on, because you're priming them early on. And the idea is not just to have the one-time asked, but to have monthly giving being part of your culture, something that you talk about a lot, that you have a defined club for it, defined benefits. Of course, it's kind of cheating at this point. Charity Water is the case study for the organization that does this so well. You can't look at any of their materials without knowing about their monthly donor program. I believe it's the Wellspring is what they call it. So test this out and measure it after 3, 6, 12 months and see if it helps take your monthly giving to the next level and maybe get some donors on board who otherwise would not become monthly donors with the conventional techniques that you're currently using for your monthly giving program. And now we've come to our closing segment here on the Dynamic Nonprofits Podcast, which is called The Postscript. And today we are going to talk about using old content to create new engagement, as well as the importance of maintaining and cataloging your content that you use your organization, as well as your prior appeals. But first, just so to give you an idea of how I came to think about this, it actually occurred when I was watching Many Saints of Newark, which was the Sopranos prequel that is currently on HBO HBO Max. And I don't know about you, but I'm a huge Sopranos fan. It is my favorite TV show of all time. And quite honestly, I think one of the most important television shows of all time, because it changed our expectations for TV. So TV used to be seen as a lesser medium compared to having movies on the big screen. And The Sopranos was really the first to bring you a highly produced weekly cinematic experience and show that it was possible to sustain that in a television show. And that really kind of kicked off what is commonly called the golden age of television, to the point now where we have shows like The Mandalorian, where each episode costs $10 million and looks like a feature movie. All of that really started with The Sopranos. Besides it being very a very big part of the experience of living in northern New Jersey during those years. I went to college at Montclair State, which was right around where a lot of the scenes for The Sopranos were filmed. And it was just, I know that The Sopranos was a cultural phenomenon, but it was just a huge part of being in northern New Jersey during that time and growing up here. And the show was very authentically Jersey, both in the locations where it took place and also the way people acted. It was, you know, very, very true to its location. But my intention in getting HBO Max, to get back to the point of this, is that I was going to watch Many Saints of Newark, and then I was going to drop it because I really fought it for a long time. It didn't want another monthly subscription. You know, already have Spotify and Netflix, and you know, it starts to add up after a while. So who wants to have another monthly streaming service that they're getting billed for? And what I quickly realized once I started going through HBO Max and looking at their catalogs is that I really kind of bought what they were doing hook, line, and sinker, and that the idea for Many Saints of Newark, in addition to driving subscriptions for HBO Max, was to get both new and old audiences into the Sopranos catalog. So streaming services like Netflix have not kept this a very quiet secret that some of the most valuable properties that they have had on there have been older TV shows that people binge and watch for hours at a time, and in a lot of cases have seen many times over, shows like The Office. And that's why Netflix just spent hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't know the exact number. I think it may have been $500 million to get the catalog to Seinfeld. And as shows have left Netflix, that's been a big blow for them because they use those older legacy pieces of content as ways to maintain, engage their audience in between the new hit Netflix shows that would come out. And that's why you're seeing companies pulling their content off of Netflix and starting their own streaming services, or these massive bidding wars for properties like The Simpsons, which is now on Disney Plus, to get these legacy pieces of content that have big catalogs that can that viewers will spend a lot of time watching, and then using that as a vehicle to engage their attention and then get them into newer properties. So In the case of how Netflix started as older content and just people binging shows that they loved. Here, HBO Max was using a newer piece of content as a gateway to get you into the older content. And not only have I started rewatching The Sopranos, which will probably be for the third time going through the series, but my wife and I actually just finished going through the entire series of Entourage, which is a show that I've seen before, but haven't seen in a long time. So it was still kind of new and fresh, and spent plenty of time on the platform. So I was probably the ideal customer for the person who held out for a long time and then got hooked in. And now it's going to have a very hard time getting rid of HBO Max because I'm getting hooked onto all these older HBO properties, as well as using it for new things that are going to be coming out, like the new Matrix movie that's due out next month. And where this kind of comes back full circle to the nonprofit world is that there's a lot of value in cataloging your content, cataloging your appeals, because, and this is especially true in the online world, in the email world. It's something that's kind of baked into the direct mail world, ironically, because it's you take for granted that it's hard to store and reference a direct mail piece unless you have a physical version of the mail piece on hand that you can easily pull. So many mailers, many agencies will hang on to their hard copies of their direct mail pieces forever. And go back to them from time to time to look for ideas that they could either update or influence new packages. So this is something that's really kind of ingrained in direct mail culture, but less so I see on the email side, whereas it's actually easier, doesn't require as much physical space to catalog all of your email appeals and your content and put it in a place where you can search. And a big reason for this, and something that is also kind of embedded in direct mail culture, is that a good idea doesn't necessarily run its course. It takes a break. So you can fatigue anything if you mail it enough, but sometimes you give it a break, you bring it back, and it comes back because it's an engaging technique. You know, we've in the direct mail world, we know that there are organizations who have evergreen packages that have been out there on and off for a decade or even more. And it's just because when you have a good idea, sometimes you just need to give people a breather and then they haven't seen it for a while. It's still engaging. Things like double envelopes are like that. You know, it always seems to be effective either in a new package or when you bring back a double envelope package. And the same thing is true on the email side or for digital appeals. And I don't see that as much where digital obviously has a much shorter shelf life. That's the challenge with digital, is that sometimes it's really a race against the clock when you find something that works, because it's going to be fatigued or it's going to be copied very quickly. And sometimes you only have a very short shelf life for something that is working on a digital platform. But these things will come back. And, you know, an example of this is a survey package or a petition package that may be very effective and then fatigues and you put it to the side. And unless you make it a regular practice to catalog your content and your appeals in a way that makes them very easy to search it can be lost to history. And there's a lot of lost knowledge, which creates additional work, brainstorming and thinking of ideas, because this information is not properly being cataloged and reused. Another example are pieces of digital content, whether it's a movie or a video clip or some sort of engagement technique. You know, we've seen this on and off in the political world, both direct mail and digital, actually, where the Constitution is a very valuable engagement device, whether it's a physical pocket Constitution that you get in a mail piece or a virtual Constitution. Anyway, you know, people get used to it. The kind of the shock and awe effect of getting something like that in the mail or in email wears off after a while. But it will come back, and you can bring it back after a year or two, and it will be effective because it's new, in the same way that if you watched The Sopranos or you watched Entourage or whatever show that you used to watch years ago on HBO, if you start getting back into it years later and rewatching it, you see things differently that you didn't see the first time, or sometimes it really is just brand new to you because it's fresh of mind. And engagement devices and appeals, both email and direct mail, are the same way. And this can especially be true if you have either lapsed donors or lapsed users. So people who haven't opened an email from you in a long time, if you want to try to send them a piece of content to create new engagement, to get them back into actively looking at your emails, going back to the well, something that is proven but maybe just dormant, is a great way to do that, because it's already kind of a known commodity and you can use that to create new engagement and hopefully keep them involved in and engaged in your future appeals. So that's our tip here, is make sure to catalog both your appeals and your content, whether it's direct mail, email, social media. Just keep a list of this stuff on hand that you can reference and go back to, because you'll save yourself a heck of a lot of time brainstorming, because you can go back to something that you already know has worked. And sometimes it has to be refreshed or you have to put a different spin on it. But Again, good techniques don't necessarily run their course. They just need to take a break. And if you do that, they often will prove to be a valuable way to engage both donors and lapsed donors alike. And we've made it to the end of our 8th full-length episode of the Dynamic Nonprofits podcast, and we thank you if you've listened wire to wire, and to everybody who has tuned into this episode. We appreciate each and every one of our listeners who takes some time to spend with us, and we hope that you got some valuable ideas and inspiration. Again, this is really just the tip of the iceberg. It's about changing our mentality, how we think about testing, and looking, always looking for the next big trend and how to test into it early in a low risk way so that we can scale those first to market advantages and get ahead of the competition. Because like it or not, both everyone in the nonprofit and for-profit world, they are competing for donor dollars and attention. And if you're able to test into new trends and find new ways to engage your donors, it's going to give your organization that much more of an advantage in your efforts. So we hope that we've inspired you with some actionable ideas, and perhaps you'll even start thinking about some new ideas that we didn't talk about here and come up with your own fundraising X tests. And Dynamic Nonprofits started as a passion project from me to the industry. It's always going to be that way. I don't have anything to sell you, but I do believe that the ideas that we talk about on this podcast, both on this episode and the other content that we put out, whether it's our interviews or our quick takes or any of the other things that we do, these are ideas that I believe are instrumental for growing the industry, an industry that I have been proud to be part of for 15 years and that I plan to be a part of for a long time to come. So the goal with this show is to put out ideas that I believe are not being talked about elsewhere and help spur growth and innovation in the nonprofit sector. And if you believe in what we're talking about here, if you think that these ideas are instrumental, or you're just hearing things that you don't hear about talked about on other nonprofit podcasts, there are a lot of great ones out there. A lot of them I listen to in my feed. An upcoming episode, I'll give you some recommendations of other podcasts that I listen to. There are a lot of great ones out there, but we do try to carve out our own unique niche. If you are hearing things that you don't hear elsewhere and you're getting some actionable insights from our discussions, the very best way to help advance our mission here at the Dynamic Nonprofits podcast is to subscribe, whether that's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your platform of choice. We are on all of them. Subscribe. You'll be the first to hear new episodes. It'll drop automatically into your feed. But also rate and review the episode. I listen to, I probably have 25 to 30 podcasts in my feed, and there's a bunch of reviews that I'm behind on as well. I know, you know, it's hard to get to these things, but it really does take only 60 seconds of your time, and your ratings and your honest reviews, they really do help us in the rankings. I haven't looked in the last couple of days, but usually we are in the top couple of nonprofit themed podcasts. And that's all because of your subscriptions and your support and telling your friends and colleagues, which is also another great way to support the show. So we appreciate you spending time with us, and anything that you can do to help us advance our mission and get the word out, connect with new fundraisers, find new guests, advance new ideas. I know I truly appreciate it. But either way, again, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. And I look forward to having many more discussions on this show and much more content coming your way the remainder of the year and going into 2022. We have some incredible surprises planned, and I cannot wait to share them with you. But until next time, this is Dan Sonner saying goodnight from New Jersey. And I wish you all a happy holiday season filled with health, happiness, and all that matters.